Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Take AIM, Accuracy in Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories the mainstream media ignore. We encourage you to visit our website at aim.org and sign up to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. I'm Roger Aronoff, a media analyst with AIM, joined today by my co-host Don Irvine, Accuracy in Media's chairman. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Roger.
So we've got another really interesting show today, and we're going to stick with our recent format after we took off last week for Thanksgiving. Our first guest up is Anna Franzanello, and she is the staff counsel for Americans United for Life, and you're going to handle that interview and introduce her. And actually, we have her on the line, and then at the bottom of the hour, I will be back on to talk about our next guest, who is George Malone of the Wall Street Journal, who is out with a new book. So, Don, go ahead and take it away. I believe we have Anna on the line.
Anna, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, great. Let me just do the quick intro. Anna Franzanello is the staff counsel with Americans United for Life. Anna formerly served as a legal fellow for Americans United for Life in 2008 and was a Blackstone Fellow with the Alliance Defense Fund. During her summer 2007 Blackstone Fellowship, she was a research assistant at the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. Anna, how and why did you become involved with the pro-life movement?
Well, my family was always very involved in the pro-life movement from the time I was little. We say we learned to walk on the picket line because I'm one of 10 kids, and we went to a lot of political functions and a lot of pro-life rallies and different things with our mother growing up. And then when I was in college, I got involved with sidewalk counseling at the abortion clinics in Pittsburgh, and through that, I realized I'd always wanted to be a lawyer, but through sidewalk counseling and talking with the women who were going into the abortion clinic and the ones that you know would turn around as well, and also talking to the husbands and boyfriends, the fathers of the babies who that were going in that day, I realized why I wanted to go into law. I wanted to be a voice for the voiceless and to stop this tragedy that's going on daily in our country.
So this is an important issue for you.
It is, yeah.
Now, this has come up as a big issue here with this whole health care reform debate.
Right.
In the House version of this bill, they passed the so-called Stupak Amendment. Exactly what is that amendment, and did it ensure the passage of the House version health care reform bill, and how? Why?
Well, the amendment itself, what it does is it puts into the House bill existing federal law, the principles of existing federal law, that there won't actually be abortion funding in healthcare. We heard a lot about from Obama, President Obama, and from other leaders in the Democrat Party, a lot about how the Hyde Amendment was going to do that. But the Hyde Amendment doesn't apply to the healthcare reform legislation because they're self-appropriating bills, which means that they don't go through the process that some other bills do that the Hyde Amendment does apply to. So what the Stupak-Pitts Amendment does is it takes those same principles that we were told would apply to health care reform and actually apply them to health care reform and continue existing federal law that we don't pay for abortions with federal dollars.
So when they were debating this, though, the health care reform bill in the House, this seemed to be kind of a key amendment in order to get the Democrats, the Blue Dogs and others, to actually vote for this legislation and get it through. Is that right?
Well, it in some ways, it's kind of Monday morning quarterbacking to say for sure, if it would have passed without the Stupak-Pitts Amendment. But, I think you look at the numbers of Democrats that voted for the amendment, and you do see that there is a strong contingency in the House of pro-life Democrats, and for many of them, this was an issue that was a make-or-break issue. For a long time, they had been told by House leadership that their amendment wasn't going to get an up or down vote. It wasn't going to come to the floor. And that's, when we see in the media that they talk about it as this is kind of this last-minute amendment, this midnight dealing kind of thing, this amendment had been out there for a long time. Stupak Pitts had offered it in committee back in July. It was very visibly advocated for several months. And then, House leadership did allow it to come to the floor. And so, the speculation is that, the bill, they needed those votes of the pro-life Democrats to get this bill to pass, because otherwise, House leadership that has been very against any kind of real actual ban on abortion funding and applying the Hyde principles to this health care reform bill, we wouldn't have seen them do that if they didn't feel that they needed those votes.
All right, so now we've seen it pass in the House and it goes to the Senate. What's happening there? I mean, is there an equivalent of the Stupak Amendment there? What do you see happening?
We will see an equivalent amendment come forth and most likely a bipartisan amendment. I know that Senator Nelson has said that that he's working on something. And there's a lot of pro-life Republicans as well who would be on board with offering language like the Stupak Pitts Amendment, as well another bipartisan pro-life amendment to keep those principles intact that have been for a long time, that we don't federally fund abortion.
And how much support is that there? I mean, I think, the common knowledge, or at least the wisdom right now, conventional wisdom, would say that the Senate bill is in a lot of trouble overall.
Mm-hmm.
Will something like this actually help it pass, or will this... bringing this up, will this kind of make the whole thing implode?
Well, I don't know. I don't think that a pro-life amendment itself in the Senate bill will make it implode in the Senate. There's less support probably from pro-life, or there's probably less pro-life Democrats in the Senate than there are in the House. But what is important is that if Congress does want to pass healthcare reform legislation, is that it would be very wise to, include the same language that the House did. Like you said before, would it have passed the House without that language? Odds are no, because the House leadership knew that, and that's why they allowed the amendment to come for a vote. If it goes back to the House with that language stripped, and there is going to be abortion funding, it won't pass the House again. So. It is important if people want to pass healthcare reform legislation that they look at the will of the people. The American public overwhelmingly says that they don't support abortion funding, and that's reflected in the vote in the Stupak Pitts Amendment as well. An even greater percentage of Americans are against abortion funding than we even saw in that strong majority vote for the Stupak Pitts Amendment. So it would be it's what the American people want. They don't want abortion funding in healthcare. Abortion is not healthcare, and the American public doesn't believe it is healthcare and doesn't want to finance it as such. So it would be in the best interest of Congress to recognize that, just to do their job and reflect the will of the people. But also, it's an important principle that has been around for a long time that should stay reflected in this legislation.
Now, a lot of pro-choice or pro-abortion advocates have argued that if Congress keeps, this Stupak Amendment in the Senate version of the bill, it'll be a huge setback for the abortion rights movement. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's not a setback for the abortion rights movement in the way that they're claiming it is, but it is it's a recognition that the American public is not accepting their mantra that abortion is healthcare. It's not, and the American public doesn't think it is. Congress doesn't think it is, and so in some ways it's a setback for them for their strategy of trying to mask abortion as healthcare. Again, they've been trying to do this for a long time with the language that they use, and they say reproductive healthcare. It's not. Abortion is not reproductive healthcare. It's not healthcare. And that's demeaning to women to say that, and the majority of women do not agree that abortion is healthcare. So it is a setback for them as far as their strategy is concerned. But it's to me, I find it insulting every time they say that this is, you know, it's hurtful to women. It's throwing women back 30, 40 years because as a woman, you know, first of all, I don't like being told by the abortion industry how I'm supposed to think. But also I think that it's insulting to me that they say that I'm not well or that I can't be well if I don't have access to abortion or if I don't have an abortion, somehow that I can't reach my full human potential. And I think that that's really demeaning to women. It says that we were created and inferior to men to even say that abortion is healthcare and is something that we need as healthcare.
And I see that, I mean, I would expect that President Obama, you know, when he ran his campaign, got large support from the pro-abortion, you know, pro-choice side of the ledger. Where is he on this position, and how has he felt about the Stupak Amendment? Has he commented on that? What does he see? What do you see going forward with that? How does all that work together with the pro-choice movement and President Obama?
Right. Well, we see that the pro-choice movement obviously backed him a lot, but I think what President Obama has also recognized is that there are many pro-life Democrats. There's many Democrats that voted for him that don't share that opinion. That's reflected by the composition of the House as well, that there are a lot of Democrats that abortion is not an issue that they were voting for Obama on. And you even see dating back to August, President Obama making statements saying, you know, we have a tradition in this town historically of not financing abortions as part of government-funded health care. And he prefaced that comment with saying, I'm pro-choice, but I think we have this principle. Whether or not, I think he's been trying to play very carefully his words because he recognizes that, obviously there's a lot of funding in the pro-abortion lobby for him, for his campaign. He made certain promises about abortion being central to healthcare, but he also recognizes that this is not what the majority of Americans want. As far as after the Stupak-Pitts Amendment was passed, President Obama, we see, him saying things that about how maybe we haven't reached common ground because there's still, a lot of strong opinions going on. But it's also important to remember something that President Obama said in his commencement speech at Notre Dame, which is where I graduated from this past year. He said that at some level, when he's talking about common ground and trying to achieve common ground, he said, we can't forget that at some level the views of these two camps are irreconcilable. So that there's always going to be debate. There's always going to be strong voices. So saying that there's strong voices after the Stupak-Pitts Amendment is, meaning that it's not common ground, that's not even what President Obama would say, really, if you listen to what he said, that there is always going to be debate, there is always going to be strong voices, because if there isn't going to be federal funding of abortion as healthcare in this healthcare reform legislation, we're going to see, Planned Parenthood and all their organizations be really upset about it. So. I think he's caught in a difficult place, and he's trying to not take a stance. But by not taking a stance in the way he's done it, he definitely has come out stronger for his pro-choice constituents. But he's trying to, at least on the surface level, say that he's against federal funding, that whatever. And I think he's trying to advocate the same phony compromise legislation language that we saw in the CAPS amendment and that we're seeing in the Senate bill with mere bookkeeping tricks, trying to say that's good enough. But the American public isn't fooled. The American public wants a federal abortion ban or abortion funding ban.
So this is kind of interesting to me. Hypothetically, if for some reason, the Senate manages to pass healthcare reform, and it does include some kind of a Stupak equivalent in there,
mm-hmm.
and this bill winds up on the president's desk to sign, does he sign the bill with that in there, or does he push that to the backside and say it's more important to have healthcare reform overall, and then just kind of abandon, I guess, his pro-choice constituency?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting scenario to think of if it actually goes through that way, because if the Senate also adopted this language and it goes back to the House, and both the House and the Senate vote on a bill that has pro-life language, I think Obama's taking the gamble that that's never going to actually happen, and it's not going to come to his desk that way, because there's pro-abortion House members who have said that they won't vote for a bill, that they're willing to abandon health care reform, if it means that abortion is not going to be funded as health care. So I think in some ways he's probably gambling that that's not actually going to happen. It's not going to come to his desk that way. But he's also, made some comments that this is a health care bill. It's not an abortion bill. So, I mean, it is possible, I think, that that he would sign the bill if it came forward without abortion funding, with that true Hyde-like language that's in the Stupak-Pitts Amendment.
Okay, now we took a look at your website, and it says that explains that any health care reform bill must contain language that explicitly excludes abortion from the required basic benefits,
right,
that any government or private plan must offer, and prohibits any taxpayer funding of abortion. Kind of mentioned that a little bit earlier. Or else the bill will require massive federal funding of abortion.
Right.
How close are we to getting that kind of language in the bill? Is that just not going to happen, or is that going to happen?
Well, the Stupak-Pitts language is the language that we say it has to be in the bill. And so the reason it has to be in the bill is that we look at Medicaid funding before the Hyde Amendment was passed. And there's court rulings that would say that without an explicit prohibition, then abortion funding is covered. So we know that there has to be an explicit prohibition, or they're going to find things like they'll say inpatient services or outpatient services will cover abortion. So the Stupak-Pitts language makes sure that it mirrors the principles of Hyde and makes sure that there truly won't be abortion funding in this new healthcare program.
Now, if that language isn't included in the bill, how will it affect abortion on the state level? How will the bill affect people, the individual people in this regard?
It's just extending I'm not sure if I understand your question exactly, what you're asking, but this is for a federal program, so it's abortion funding. It's a prohibition on abortion funding through a federal program.
Right, but so that won't have any effect on the state level, or will the states likely to follow the federal model?
Well, states can still, as they can in Medicaid, the prohibition on abortion funding in Medicaid doesn't affect a state's ability to fund abortion. So a state can fund abortion. This is just a ban on federal funding of abortion.
You mentioned earlier about the Stupak Amendment actually had been proposed back in July. We really hadn't heard anything about it. I certainly had not heard anything about it until it came up just in that final debate phase. How do you feel, from your point of view, the job that the media has done, the mainstream media has done in covering, this information, and what's been going on here with this bill and with abortion?
Well, I think we see a definite bias in most of the mainstream media. As far as they saying that, it was sprung last minute, which it wasn't. It was offered back in July. It had been publicly advocated for. But also, we see other things that they're doing where they keep painting this as, the Catholic bishops did this. That's a strategy that the abortion lobby has been using for about 100 years, since Margaret Sanger. Their big thing has been to paint this as it's the Catholic Church versus everybody else, and it's not. And we can see that in, the numbers of people that support a federal funding ban. 61% to 71% that we see in these numbers in the polls, and that's way more than we have Catholics. So it's not a Catholic thing. It's not a thing that, it's just the bishops. But that's how the media paints it out, is that the bishops did this and that it's the Catholic Church. And also they keep painting it as it's a men versus women thing as well. Obviously Bart Stupak has been a leader for the pro-life Democrats on this issue, but there's also, it's forgotten in the media that Kathy Dalkemper and Marcy Kaptur are also co-sponsors of this bill, and that there are many co-sponsors of the amendment, and there are many women who voted for this amendment, and that there are many women who share the opinion of those women in the House and myself that we don't want to fund abortion. And it's not just a pro-life issue either. There are many people who are pro-choice who say that they are against funding abortion. Even if they're for legal abortion, they don't see abortion as being healthcare and being funded through healthcare legislation. So I think they keep, you know, they're trying to narrow, you know, the pro-lifers down to, you know, all male Catholic bishops, and it's not. It's women. It's women as well as men. It's Catholics as well as Protestants and Jews and people of all faiths and or no faith. It's pro-lifers and pro-choicers as well. But they, you know, that's their strategy to try to minimize pro-lifers, to try to marginalize them. And the fact is that the majority of America self-identifies as pro-life, and even more than that, is against federal funding of abortion.
If you could advise the mainstream media, what would you ask them to focus on more with this issue?
I guess I would say honesty. Recognizing that the majority of America does not want to fund abortion through healthcare, and that by advocating or by playing to Planned Parenthood and NOW and other pro-abortion groups, what they're doing is that they're turning off many Americans who really are against federal funding of abortion, and it's the majority of Americans. It's not so they're alienating, you know, a large part of America by demeaning their opinion, and also they're demeaning many women, because especially the way that they paint this out as, you know, a women's issue, they're demeaning a lot of women. So I think that I would say to them, you know, it's a matter of being honest, but also recognizing that you're alienating the majority of Americans when you keep telling them, you know, that trying to marginalize them. And I think, you know, they'd do better in their ratings if they were honest and weren't alienating.
So how can Americans learn more about this information if the media isn't telling them?
Well, I think we have a great age for that because we have the Internet, and there's a lot of blogs. There's a lot of pro-life groups like ours, Americans United for Life. You can check out our website and our blog and sign up for our email alerts and everything. So I think it's very easy to stay informed, and you don't have to rely on mainstream media anymore. Back in when Margaret Sanger was making up her lies about what was going on, you know, it was harder to find out the truth. But it's a lot easier now to seek the truth and to understand. I also think it's important for people to actually read the amendment and the provisions in the bill. I know that the bills themselves are extremely long, so I'm not saying you have to read all 2,000 pages, but when people are talking about the Stupak-Pitts Amendment, go and read the amendment. I think that, you know, you'll see the language that's actually in there and what it actually says and what it requires, and not just relying on op-ed pieces to tell you what something says. I think, we have access to all of these bills and these amendments, and they're worth reading. And sometimes, you know, obviously the legalese is going to be hard to understand, but I think, you know, check out Americans United for Life website, and we break it down for you pretty easily, showing the language and also with the breakdown of what it actually does. So I think Americans should stay informed, but also inform everyone else. It's worth sharing with your friends and family. I know that my family likes to talk about politics and these things a lot. Not everyone is so inclined, but I think it is very important. We're facing a very large bill that is going to affect all of our lives dramatically. And so I think it's worth getting involved. It's worth sharing the information that you know and not just relying on op-eds and mainstream media to do that.
Now, one place, obviously, this could become a very big decision, and once again, you know, maybe back to the Supreme Court at some point in time, and we got a new justice this past year. I know your organization got involved with that. I mean, do you have any feelings or predictions going forward of what the Supreme Court will do if this issue, you know, lands back in their front, in their court, I guess, as such?
Well, the Stupak Pitts Amendment, we know that it's a constitutional amendment. It mirrors Hyde, and the Hyde Amendment was defended before the Supreme Court by Americans United for Life, it's a constitutional provision. There's nothing unconstitutional about it, and we know that with Stupak Pitts. So I think even with the constitution of the court that we have right now, I think there's clear precedent on this issue, and I feel strongly that they would uphold it just as they did the Hyde Amendment for the same reasons. I'm not sure that it would even have to go that far to be upheld, it's very clearly a constitutional amendment.
It seems like the culture of abortion, though, is quite prevalent in our society. Do you believe that's going to be changing in the coming years?
I'm hopeful that it is. I think that there's a lot more information now as well, that I think, things like informed consent laws, ultrasounds, are helping to change the attitude towards life in utero, and people recognizing that it is life. We saw that story recently about the Planned Parenthood director in Texas who quit when she actually saw an abortion, the ultrasound of an abortion. And so I think that with technology, there's a lot of great things that come from that. It's the same thing that Dr. Bernard Nathanson, who is an abortionist and big in the movement to legalize abortion back in the late 60s, early 70s, he also left. He stopped being an abortionist when he saw an ultrasound and actually understood what was going on. So I think, obviously there are people that see ultrasounds and know what's going on and are going to continue to be a part of the abortion lobby. But I think many people are coming to an understanding of what life really is. I am hopeful that I don't think abortion is going to end tomorrow or in 5 years, but I think that there can be and should be a renewal in our society. I think that there is a recognition that life has value from its earliest stages, and that it doesn't matter how old you are or where you are, but that your life has dignity. And I think people are starting to recognize that.
I believe your organization follows what happens on the abortion issue in the states. What is going on there? Is there a general trend to ban funding of abortion in the states? Has it become a more pro-life state legislatures across the country? Are we seeing, there's a balance? Where are we on that?
I think, each state is different. So there are many states that have very strong pro-life legislation, and we are seeing things that like in Oklahoma, even they passed a ban on sex selection abortions, and that was overwhelmingly voted for by both Republicans and Democrats, and signed into law by a self-described pro-choice governor. So I think we see a lot of things, a lot of legislation, that we would call common ground, I guess, even legislation, to use the word of President Obama, but that we see there are a lot of laws that are being passed that that recognize that abortion on demand for any reason is not what Americans want, and we see that in many states, and I think it depends. There are some states that are obviously still more abortion-friendly than others, but we see a lot of states that have parental notification laws and working for ultrasound laws and informed consent laws, things that should be common ground everywhere.
Do you see any one state in particular as being a model for pro-life legislation?
If you go again to our website, we have rankings of all the states and with their laws. I don't know off the top of my head which one I would say, but I think I know Georgia has some good pro-life legislation. I know Oklahoma has passed some things recently as well.
Okay, and we need to wrap this up, but what other issues in terms of what other things are you guys working on in particular on this?
Federally, and then are you talking about with abortion funding or just abortion in general?
Whatever you're doing at this point. You know, we've been mainly focusing on the health care reform bill, but what other things is your organization doing?
Right. Well, you know, Americans United for Life is involved in all 50 states, so we do a lot. I mean, we have the three prongs that we're involved in: litigation, legislation, and education. That applies not just at the federal level, but in the states as well. We work with states to help pass pro-life legislation and also help defend their pro-life legislation because we know that, you know, Planned Parenthood is going to attack any parental notification law or informed consent, anything that they see as a restriction on abortion, they're going to attack it. So we help states with pro-life legislation, both passing and defending, we've been working on everything from conscience rights, to informed consent laws, ultrasounds, and trying to enact as much legislation as we can to help protect life and from its beginning stages to its end stages and to protect women and men in the process as well.
All right, great. We need to run now. Can you just give our listeners your website address so
yes.
I can follow up with you?
It's AUL.org or blog.AUL.org.
Well, great. I appreciate your time today to discuss this very important issue and hope to talk to you again in the future.
All right. Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, Don, that was a great interview, and thank you for that. And I'm going to take over at this point. I believe George Malone is on the phone with us. Are you there, George?
Yes, I am.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us on Take Aim. And let me tell our listeners a little bit about you. You spent a remarkable 54 years with the Wall Street Journal as a writer and editor. And most recently, he was responsible for the oversight of the journal's overseas editorial pages. He's won numerous awards for his work and is the author of, I believe, two books, including The Carter Economy, which you co-authored with your wife, Jody, and the brand-new book, which is the reason we called you to come on today, The Great Money Binge, Spending Our Way to Socialism. So welcome, and I've got so many things when I started making out the questions that I wanted to ask you. My list is too long for the time we have, so maybe we can briefly touch on a lot of different things. But one thing that I want to start with is how the Wall Street Journal is an institution, not only in this country, but throughout the world. And I talk to groups and point out that it used to be our only daily national newspaper. While primarily a business-oriented paper, the editorial page, which has always been independent from the news pages, has been such a vital voice in shaping American policy, foreign and domestic. Tell us about the culture of the paper and sort of the sense of pride you have felt being there for so many years.
Well, I think the journal editorial policy is very traditional. It grows out of John Locke, the English philosopher, and the founding fathers, basically. It's dedicated to freedom. It was for many years opposed to any form of state control, communism, whatever. And it's a newspaper editorial page philosophy that upholds the individual and the his freedom and initiative.
It is also noted for being the only publication that has found sort of a profitable formula for charging people to subscribe online. Why do you think the journal is unique in that sense?
Well, I think simply because we tried it, actually, and found that people were willing to pay a subscription fee for online news. And it's kind of our basic philosophy for many years was that if you provide a valuable service, you should charge for it. I mean, you know, it has value.
Right.
And we just never could quite understand the idea that a news organization should give its product away to the public. So that's the reason, and it has worked very well. Over 1 million online subscribers, and they pay not a very large sum, but they're willing to pay money to get that service.
How has the acquisition by Rupert Murdoch of the Journal changed the culture around there, and is the editorial page as independent as it used to be?
It is. Murdoch has made some very important changes in the newspaper, but the editorial pages are just the way they always were, and certainly he's he has not touched the traditional philosophy of the editorial page, and you know, he's a very bright fellow, and he knows that that's a very important part of the Journal's attraction to readers. Bob Bartley, the former editor, the late editor of the Wall Street Journal, used to say, "We're the only editorial page that actually sells newspapers," and that sounds like a boast, but I think he's right. He was right about that.
Well, another boast for Bob Bartley and for the Journal and you in particular is the Wall Street Journal's role in the sort of the whole supply side economic revolution and the Reagan revolution and basically the boom to the U.S. economy. Tell us about that. I mean, how that came about and the Journal's role in that whole movement.
Supply-side economics is just the name for traditional economics. As I say, the Journal editorial philosophy is very traditional. And supply-side economics, when you distill it down to the basics, it simply means if you want to eat, you have to work, and government policies should encourage human initiative and production. And production creates its own demand. So that's classical economics. It goes mm-hmm. all the way back. I don't know how far, but Ibn Khaldun was one exponent of that particular just simple logic.
But you provided the platform for people like Arthur Laffer and Jude Winiski and Jack Kemp to sort of lay out the case, which sort of became the Reagan policy.
We did, and that was under Bob Bartley's leadership. Bob was a prescient fellow, and he and I both sort of came from modest beginnings in the Middle West, and I think had some grounding in those kind of basic principles. So Bob was brought these people like Laffer and Bob Mundell. Mundell was a very important factor in the philosophy and wrote some very good stuff for us. So did Laffer, Jack Kemp, as you say. And I don't know that we actually had much to do with I think Ronald Reagan was one of us, too. I mean, you know, he came from a very modest beginning in the Middle West, and I think he understood supply-side principles instinctively. But it all came together, the movement, the economists who signed on to that particular idea, and it all came together in the Reagan administration and was implemented into policy, thanks also in part to Jack Kemp's leadership in Congress.
A lot of people today seem to want to revise the history, and even though Reagan brought down the marginal individual tax rates from 70 down to 28, he did raise other taxes, I guess, Social Security and other things, and so they're trying to say, well, no, he wasn't this great tax cutter, but what's the distinction there between the tax cutting he did and the tax raising he did?
Well, the tax cutting he did was at the higher marginal rates, and very often those high marginal rates, they were up to 70% on the highest brackets at one point, didn't really yield much revenue for one thing, and they certainly discouraged private investment and private initiative, and that was the supply side, that was one of the supply side instincts that if you cut those high marginal rates, you would encourage work and production, and Reagan believed in that, and so that was his main contribution. It had to do with adjusting the rates so that they were reasonable even at the higher levels.
So let's jump to the current century, and what were the real causes of the current economic crisis that we're in?
Well, there were several, but in my book, I go back to the housing policies. We've had housing policies. The federal government has intervened in the housing market for decades, but the affordable housing initiatives in the 1990s sort of laid the groundwork for what came later, and that was basically because the government started actually forcing banks, requiring them to make what were risky, you might even say bad loans. And those loans, there was a market for those loans at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the government-sponsored enterprises that provided a secondary market for mortgage loans. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac then took these questionable loans and bundled them into mortgage-backed securities and sold them all around the world. Eventually, Wall Street got into that too, and the world was blanketed with these doubtful mortgage-backed securities. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve in the early 2000s opened the monetary spigots to deal with the the recession of 2001. And then didn't close them again when the economy began to recover. And so the crucial year was about 2003, when they just simply left the target interest rate down to its low level and created a credit bubble. So we had the combination of a credit bubble, which of course fueled a bubble in housing prices. And when that all began to collapse, these bad loans were exposed for what they were. And the entire mortgage-backed security market just sort of froze up. And that was a $7 trillion supply of these. They weren't all faulty, certainly not all the mortgages, but there were enough of them that we got what was called toxic securities.
So you're talking about the sort of chain of events, the the laws passed by Congress to encourage banks to make these loans to people who weren't really qualified, and then Fannie and Freddie taking them and then bundling them, and then Wall Street getting into the act as well. Yet I think the narrative you hear in the media primarily is that this was greedy Wall Street bankers that fueled this whole thing, rather than following the lead of Congress and Fannie and Freddie. What do you say to that?
Well, I think the media, they seem a lot of. Of course, the media is highly diverse, but a lot of the reporters are influenced unduly, I think, by politicians, and certainly politicians are not going to take the blame for causing a problem of this magnitude, so they foisted it off on Wall Street, which is always a good whipping boy. I mean, sure, Wall Street is that's kind of the way Wall Street works, on the basis of greed. People are trying to make money. So they make a nice whipping boy, but in fact, the federal government was fundamentally responsible for creating the situation, and has now compounded it with further excesses.
Have we learned the right lessons and done anything to change those policies, like the loans for to people who can't afford the houses? I mean, have these things changed and basically kind of reversing the policy, or are we continuing on?
No, I think that's the dismaying thing. They haven't changed. And in fact, the present Congress, well, of course, it was the same Congress last year as well. I mean, it's the Democratic-controlled Congress. And the administration have actually compounded the problem the bailout of the banks, $700 billion after the crisis of last year, has been compounded by further excesses in federal spending to the point where the Treasury in the last fiscal year, ending in September 30th, they had to raise $1.7 trillion net to finance the government. That's an incredible amount of money. And
so
we're running a real, this deficit is a serious matter.
So about that, it was last September, I believe, when Lehman Brothers went down, and then they quickly gathered together and did this TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program, and in just a few weeks just said we basically needed to appropriate this $700 billion or, the world was coming to an end. I'm wondering, how did you feel about it at the time that there was this pressure to pass that, and now looking back, have your views changed on that?
Well, the Wall Street Journal actually supported the TARP program. Of course, I'm retired, so I'm sitting on the sidelines. I had some doubts about it, but I can see why they did. I mean, we knew the problem was in the financial sector was very serious, and there were other things that could have been done at that point that were not done. The accounting principle of mark-to-market, which actually was installed when the government took over accounting regulation, that could have been suspended, which would have given the banks some relief from the pressure of what to do about these toxic securities. And so there were, the government just sort of followed the instinct of throwing money at the problem. And I think looking back, that was probably not such a good idea.
And this money. This is kind of a technical question, but that $700 billion, was it added on to the deficit from that year, meaning that the Bush administration left with a $1.2 trillion or so deficit, and that the deficits we're seeing now aren't that much more than they were then, or was that somehow considered off the books from the deficit?
No, I don't think it was off the books. It was the bailout money was regarded as an investment that would be eventually repaid.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it all wasn't. It hasn't all been spent either.
Right.
But so, in a sense, you could say it's off the books if you consider it an investment as opposed to an expenditure. The government did receive preferred stock in these various organizations that it bailed out, like Citigroup, and in a sense, they have something to show for what they put in, but still, it was cash that had to be supplied by the Treasury.
If you had been asked to come up with a stimulus plan at the point that Obama and the Democrats came up with this $787 billion stimulus package, what would yours have looked like?
Well, it would not have looked at all like the one that the Congress actually voted and Obama signed. That was a Keynesian program. We sort of reverted back to that old Keynesian formula. And that has been discredited time and again. I mean, the Keynesian idea was that if the government spends a dollar, you expand the economy by a dollar and a half. Well, it has never actually worked that way. And government spending doesn't stimulate anything. It has to come from the taxpayer or somebody out of the capital markets or somewhere. So it doesn't really stimulate. If you want to stimulate, the best thing to do is cut taxes. But the best thing to do is not get yourself into this kind of situation in the first place.
Another thing you talk about in your book is the what you call the disdain for property rights, and kind of example number one is the Chrysler deal. Kind of just change the whole notion of people who had specific deal and how the government could just come in and change it. I mean, tell us about the significance of how the government handled the Chrysler situation.
Well, when a corporation issues bonds, securities, there are different levels of creditors, and some creditors have seniority. They're supposed to be paid back first if the company goes broke. The government just stepped in and changed that, and the senior creditors just simply declared by fiat that that some other creditors, primarily the UAW pension funds, would get seniority over what were supposed to be the senior creditors. So now, you know, you can understand that, and that there are a lot of people out there who depend on their Chrysler pensions. On the other hand, this is when you start breaking contracts just willy-nilly, that is a very serious violation of property rights, and it's high-handed government. So it's something that you really, the public should be very wary of, you know, the next time somebody else might be the victim of this.
Well, is there evidence that that has shaken the confidence of investors from around the world to put their money in corporate America?
Well, I don't know that there is any evidence. It's hard to know if there's any evidence of that. The decline of the dollar certainly has shaken the confidence, and of course all those toxic securities that were distributed around the world. Most people who bought those, they did have AAA ratings, despite the bad mortgages that were included in those for the backing of those securities. And most people who bought them thought they were perfectly safe, that they had the backing, essentially, of the United States government. And I suppose that's one reason the government has gone to such pains to try to bail out the owners of those securities through the Fed buying trillions, or buying maybe up to $1 trillion or more worth of those. So a lot of things have shaken the confidence of overseas investors, and probably, when a government starts breaking contracts, I'm sure that has some effect.
The subtitle of your book is Spending Our Way to Socialism. When does big government become socialism?
Well, it becomes socialism when it starts taking over things, starts running things. Of course, the primary objective of the Obama administration is fundamentally a takeover of the healthcare industry. And the cap and trade bill in Congress is fundamentally a takeover of the energy industry. And of course, the specific ownership of the means of production, you could say, well, to the takeover of General Motors was kind of old-fashioned socialism in a way, in the guise of a bailout. But the government has been expanding its control over various parts of our economy over the last year. And when the government is doing that, you're heading down the road to socialism. Of course, the ultimate in that was the old Soviet Union, where the government owned everything, and it didn't work.
George, we just have a couple of minutes left. Let me try a couple things real quickly. How do you explain, this might take too long, but the situation with China today, that they're our largest creditor, we depend on them to sell our bonds to have enough cash to keep operating. Does this somehow suggest that their economy has succeeded and where ours has failed?
No, I don't think so. What it suggests is that free trade is a very, very valuable thing. We had this marvelous circular arrangement going with the Chinese. They bought our bonds and sold us low-cost goods, and American workers could buy stuff at Walmart that, to support their standard of living, and we didn't really suffer unemployment as a result. Somehow, everything, we had pretty close to full employment for a long time, and it all worked very well. So, no, I don't think the Chinese have been taking advantage of us. We've just had a mutual arrangement. But we now they now hold a lot of our debt.
So, real quickly, are you optimistic these days that we will get through this and survive as a prosperous nation? And then finally, where can people find your books and where can they find you online?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm optimistic. I think we've got a big problem here financing this deficit that we're running. But my book is available. Simon & Schuster. It's out in the bookstores, and I'm sure Amazon has it, and forth. And I'm on my email address is george.malone@wsj.com.
Okay, and let me tell everyone, just if you're looking it up on Amazon, Malone, it's not M-A-L-O-N-E, it's M-E-L-L-O-A-N. And George, it's been great having you on here, real honor, and thank you so much. And the book is a great read. I recommend it to everyone.
Thank you very much.
You bet. So, folks, that is it for this week. We will be back with another excellent show next week, next Thursday. I want to thank our producer, Sarah Norton, and so long till next week.